Business University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today is our guest, Dr. Elijah Anderson, the Charles and William L. Day Distinguished Professor of the Social Sciences and Professor of Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and a former Vice President of the American Sociological Association. His many publications include books on his extensive research on the causes and some of the responses to violence in inner cities, particularly African American communities. His well-known work, winner of the Eastern Sociological Society's Kamarovsky's Book Award, Code of the Street, Decency, Violence, and the Moral Life of the Inner City. Dr. Anderson has taken a leadership role through his very active involvement in the struggle to make a difference. And I'm honored, Dr. Anderson, to have you on University Forum.
Well, I'm honored to be here.
Well, I thank you for taking time out of, I know it's a very, very busy life that you lead.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Well, there's so much to talk about. What's going on with all the killings that we're seeing now in the cities? What's mm-hmm. the nature of this? What is all that violence
about? I think it's complicated. There are various forms of violence, of course. But the kind that we hear about so much and the kind that we read about so much in the news involves tensions between people and need to set people straight, the need to get what's yours. People seem to be very proprietary about what is what is yours, what is mine. It seems that there's a level of scarcity in the inner city that we've not seen for a long, long time. A lot of this violence is associated with poverty. The poverty, though, is a different type of poverty than what we're used to. The poverty that we see today has got to be understood as structural poverty, meaning that a lot of it emanates from, the situation of capital flowing out of the community, decisions being made by certain decision makers to take plants away, to take jobs away. You see, we as a country, as a society, and as a city, as an economy, are moving through profound and utter change from manufacturing as a way to organize the economy to service and high technology. And so many of the jobs are moving away from the inner city to non-metropolitan America. They're moving to the suburbs. They're moving to edge cities. They're moving to developing countries like Mexico and beyond that, overseas to China, to India. You see, all of this poverty that we see is going on in an increasingly globalized world, where the boundaries, the national boundaries, are more and more permeable. And so capital and people can move more easily across these barriers, these boundaries. I said the poverty that we see is structural. Increasingly, as I say, the jobs are moving away. We're faced with deindustrialization. And this is not peculiar to Philadelphia, but to many, many cities, many, many urban settings that used to have strong manufacturing bases. And today, increasingly, what you see is the deindustrialization process, which leaves the factory jobs go and service industries develop, where people who now used to work in high-paying manufacturing jobs that required little in the way of education and skill, now are moving into the service economy, the lowest levels of which oftentimes don't pay people enough money to live. And in order to make it in this new economy, one must have human capital. That is, you must be able to read, to write, to figure, to compute. You must have credentials. You must have education and skills that are marketable in this new economy. And so many of the schools that would train young people, not just African Americans, but other minorities, including Hispanics and even poor whites, a lot of these schools are not really effectively doing their jobs. And so what you have is kind of a disconnect. And you have unemployment that is, as I say, increasingly structural. There are mismatch issues and all of that. There's also mismatch in terms of where the jobs are located. It takes a couple of hours to get from North Philadelphia to King of Prussia, where many of the jobs begin to emerge, you see. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, the jobs were right in the neighborhood, you see. Factories like the Bud Company and a whole host of companies. As you take a train to New York and you look outside your window, you see all these disused factories. They're quiet now. But at one time, they hummed, and they supported the life in North Philadelphia, Kensington, various other areas in the city. And so when that was going on, the communities were healthier in a certain sense, socially, you know. Mm-hmm. There were more nuclear-like families.
Yeah.
Today, increasingly, what you see are female-headed households in so many of these communities that once supported nuclear families, you see.
But we know of many nuclear families or one-parent families that somehow have survived. I think in your book you talk about the decent families and the street families, where they come in the same environment.
That's right. You don't have to have a nuclear family to be decent, that's for sure.
Yeah?
There are many, many families that are headed by women that are decent. They're orderly. They do all the things that they should do. But what I'm talking about is the fact that increasingly we have poverty that is structural. And you have single breadwinners where at one point you had, you know, two, or you had a man who had a factory job who could support a family. And this has changed now. And so much of what you see in so many of the neighborhoods used to be, you know, humming with men and jobs and families. And increasingly what you have is single mothers on welfare. And the children who had emerged in this situation are oftentimes without the benefit of a family that we know in the traditional sense. And oftentimes the children growing up in these situations raise themselves. This is not the working class. This is not the middle class. We're talking about the very poor, the people who are really at the very bottom of the system, people who are unable oftentimes to make an effective adjustment to this transition that we're moving through.
You give a good description of that.
And really to make that effective adjustment, one needs the human capital. One needs the skills, the education, but also social capital in the sense that you need a system that is receptive to people, if you know what I mean. And you need a kind of nurturance of people by one another. Yeah. And you're not getting that so much today in these environments. And so the violence that we see is complicated by all these kinds of considerations. But probably most importantly, in the areas of concentrated urban poverty, and I mean the ones that are really, really being buffeted by the global economy in ways that really leave them very, very poor in a structural sense, what you have in the community is a certain isolation and segregation. And there's a feeling among a lot of the people, whether it's warranted or not, that the wider society has abdicated its responsibility to the community. That is, if you look at the jobs and where people work, a lot of people don't work, can't work. You look at the issue of public safety and the police. Sometimes when you call the police come late or they may not come. Whether this is true in some objective sense, a lot of the people in the community believe it to be so. And they build their lives, they structure their lives accordingly. So in these communities, what you have is a limited amount of faith in the civil law. And so when that's true, then street justice fills the void. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. a peculiar system of social exchange where respect becomes the coin, street credibility becomes the coin. Even for people who are otherwise law-abiding, they realize that in order to take care of themselves, they have to develop some kind of reputation for being able to give as good as they get, to be able to respond to violations to their persons, to people messing with their sister, to people messing with their mothers, their cousins, or whatever. And the only way they feel that you can deal with this is to have a track record where the last person who tried that got beaten up by you. So there's a great emphasis on reputation and street cred. But the street cred comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of doing deeds that are oftentimes violent or border on violence, you see. To build that kind of capital, one has to be violent. So what you have is people on edge, being on edge, you see.
They're angry.
Yes, angry, but at the same time have little faith in the civil law. If they're going to take care of themselves, they've got to do it themselves. So the community is beset with this. And from what I've been able to understand as someone who goes into the community, I spend time at laundromats, I spend time at churches, I spend time at barbershops and places, I talk to people. What you see, basically, is that people divide themselves into the street and the decent world. Now, most people are trying to be decent. They're decent and trying to be decent. Nobody calls themselves street. Mm-hmm. I'm street. Street is an epithet that the decent people, quote unquote, oftentimes apply to people who don't meet their standards and norms. And the decent people make up a majority of people. And these people oftentimes raise their children to be law-abiding, to respect other people, to go to school, to go to church, whatever it is, to work hard, to make a living in a decent way. Treat other people right, to go to church and what have you. But there's another element that is the street. And again, these are their labels, not mine. And the street label applies to people who the decent people are ready to see as ignorant, as uncouth, as people who will fight at the drop of a hat, as people who beat up the children in public and cuss them out and things like that. Those people are street in the minds of people who see themselves as decent. So that's the division in the community. And the decent people understand that when they come out of their homes and walk the streets, it's better to be taken as street than decent.
To protect the device.
Yeah, because decency shown in public, they feel oftentimes, can get you hurt. That you'll be eaten alive if you're too decent.
Literally.
So really what you have here is that the people who are decent and trying to be decent are really under terrific pressure in these communities that are so compromised by the economy, so compromised by the inattention of the civil authorities, so compromised by the alienation of the people who are deeply street, you see. And that's what creates the violence. People have short fuses, you see, and they can't wait for the authorities to come and take care of them. They've got to take care of themselves. So this is what contributes to the violence. Now, one more thing that's important here is the drug trade, because the community itself, from what I've been able to understand, by talking to people, by listening to people, by observing, making sense of it all, the economy of this inner-city community rests on three sources: low-wage jobs, welfare payments, or what's left of them, and the idiosyncratic, irregular, underground economy of hustling, begging, borrowing, street crime, drugs, what have you. Now, each one of these is a source of money. And one can be involved in the low-wage job, but still be involved in welfare, still be involved in the underground economy. Or one can be totally absorbed in one or the other of these. These pieces work in tandem, and they help to circulate money within the community. But if you cut off any one of these, if you cut off welfare, you encourage people to go to the other two sources. If you cut off the low-wage jobs, make them more competitive, make them unable to get, you push people to the irregular underground economy of hustling and drug dealing and what have you. And in that setting, the civil law does not apply. All of these transactions that are being made in this irregular underground economy are done without the benefit of civil law. And that, again, is where the violence comes in.
You're listening to University Forum. I'm Jean Moore. My guest is Dr. Elijah Anderson, an eminent sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, who has been instrumental in bringing people together to discuss the issue of violence in the city, particularly the African-American areas of the inner city. Dr. Anderson, as we see some of the dynamics of the community, one of the things that we haven't gotten to yet in terms of violence is the nature of the violence and the intrusion into the community now of weapons, a little bit different than the days when they would get mad and just fight each other. What's happened as far as guns, and how is that affecting some of this violence and this killing?
Well, guns are quite prevalent today, legal and illegal. And that's the problem in a way, because the legal guns can become illegal so easily. People purchase them legally. They lose them in robberies. They lose them quite literally sometimes, or they leave them unchecked and children get them. And at the same time, there are gun sellers, gun dealers, who purchase guns and then resell them. You can actually buy a gun and lose it and not have to report it on the day that you lost it. You simply say, I lost it, and then you are relieved of any responsibility for that weapon. Mm. So you have people who purchase one, two, three, four guns or whatever and sell them. And sometimes the guns are purchased legally. Sometimes they're purchased on the black market. And then they're sold in the communities of Philadelphia. There, you can ride around on a Saturday sometimes, the neighborhoods, and you can see people selling guns out of the trunks of their cars to anybody who's got the money. Also, people can rent guns now.
How's that?
People rent guns now. They rent them from an old head. I mean, young boys do sometimes. If they need a gun, they do this. So it's not hard to get a gun, you see. And at the same time, a gun enhances one's respect on the street, you see. You say gun, and people are ready to defer to you. Mm. And so it's a major, major, major asset in terms of the capital that people need to operate in public. But if you, and it's certainly not something I'm advocating, but young people see it as a protective device, a source of protection, you see. Also, with the breakdown of the regular economy, what you have is the underground economy emerging, and specifically drug dealing. And the drug trade in Philadelphia and other places, I think, but especially Philadelphia, is organized in terms of the top dogs, the middle dogs, and the low dogs. The low dogs are the drones, oftentimes. These are kids from 18 to 20 years of age, sometimes even younger, sometimes down to 13 or 14 years of age. Mm-hmm. And these are people who sometimes make money by picking up a package, so to speak, holding a package, or even delivering a package from one place to another, from one depot to another. And
The young women get involved in that quite often, too, don't they?
I think anybody who needs the money can get involved. Yeah. But the point here is that if you operate in the drug trade at that level, or if you simply stand on the corner as an 18-year-old selling drugs to bypassers, you can't do that without a gun. You need a gun to do that. And usually the people who do that have a gun.
Because
they need to deter people who might rob them, you see. These can be addicts or others. But oftentimes, the young drug dealer is especially concerned about the stick-up boy. You see, the poverty that we see has given rise to a group of stick-up boys who make it their business to go around and rob drug dealers, you see, either of their money or their drugs. And so the young boys who stand in the corners from, you know, from the ages of 14 on, who might sell drugs, require a pistol to deter these boys who might rob them. And the stakes are rather high, because if the young boy cannot account for his money or his drugs to the person who fronted him the drugs, then that young boy's life is on the line. And so it's very important to be able to control your drugs or your money once you're fronted them. And some of the young boys, too, being children, when they come into money, they run through it. They may go to the mall with their friends, buy clothes, buy shoes, buy sneaks, buy gold, whatever it is, or take their girlfriends or relatives even to eat out, whatever it is. They go through the money sometimes. When they go through the money, they're not thinking about their drug bill. These are kids sometimes, you see. And so when they can't pay their drug bill at the end of the month or whatever it is to the middle dog who fronted them the drugs in the first place, they're in trouble.
Their life is on the line then.
Yeah, because the middle dog can't really stand a trifling low dog, you see, because his credibility becomes at issue. And so this is a very important source of violence, these kinds of transactions going wrong, people not meeting their responsibilities. And if they're kids, they're less likely to meet their responsibilities in the eyes of the middle dog. And so what you have then is a reason for violence. And oftentimes the violence that we see may well be attempts to settle scores, you see. And then in that settling of scores and concern about, you know, what's mine and what's yours, you know, what belongs to me, what you owe me, that kind of, you have gunfights. And then innocent bystanders get shot and killed. Little children, you see, older people. And what I'm saying is not something that is like some big secret. If you go into the community and talk to people, they know this. They understand what I'm talking about. And I've learned it by talking to them.
Do they have some answers to this?
Well, they a lot of these people are afraid. They're afraid. A lot of them don't trust the authorities. A lot of people, unfortunately, are cynical. They feel that the police might turn them in to the drug dealers. They feel that if they call the police and tell on somebody or snitch, that somebody might come after them.
Mm-hmm. I can remember an incident in New York some years ago where there were two gangs at that time fighting each other, and the cops came and stayed outside with the hope, I guess, or the thought that maybe they'll just kill each other off, and that was it. And that was very obvious to those who were there.
Yeah. Well, some of the people are, as I say, there's a lack of faith in the civil law, mm-hmm. you know, and so people don't know what to do except to do the best they can to take care of their own. And in that regard, it's very important to have street cred, because that's the kind of capital that allows people, you know, presumably to operate in public. And the street capital comes at a high cost, because you have to do deeds in order to gain that capital. You must exhibit violence in order to have street credibility.
And you know a lot of this because you spent quite a bit of time in the communities.
Yes.
And learned by almost living with them.
Well, I know drug dealers. I know people who've been to jail. I've talked with them. I've eaten lunch with them. I've had drinks with them. I've even been in crack houses with people. And by doing this, you learn. And what I'm sharing with you is really coming from that kind of field work, as it were.
And it's a different kind of research than the kind that come from pulling material from someone else's book in terms of what you put down.
Right.
It's your work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's called participant observation. ethnography, the systematic study of culture. The idea is to apprehend, comprehend, understand, and then attempt to represent or render this particular world that you've come to understand. And that's what I try to do in my work.
And your book, especially the one, The Code of the Street, really deals with this quite extensively as you go down Germantown Avenue and see the change in the fabric of the community itself from one end to the other, mm-hmm. this being a thoroughway and a throughway mm-hmm. from parts of the Philadelphia area. We're going to spend a lot of time after this program talking about what we see as some of the responses and hopefully some of the remedies and things that have been done and have not been done as far as some of the issues that you've raised. If we were to speak of one or two major concerns, one of them may well be what happens to the family itself, to the people who have these children, and what about the grandmothers and people who somehow end up taking care of these youngsters, particularly when people go to prison mm-hmm. and the whole prison population in that whole area there.
Yeah.
But right now, as we end, just one or two words about you. You have been doing this work for about how long, Dr. Anderson?
At least 30 years, yeah.
At least 30 years as far as studying and living with all the areas that you're describing here. It's not just a question of conversation on this. You have background information from immersing yourself, not only in Philadelphia, but in another city as well, right? Mm-hmm.
Chicago, yeah.
Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you were at Northwestern University at the time?
Yeah, the University of Chicago, Northwestern.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I want to thank you so much for this first program, and we're going to continue it in the second show as we move on to talk about what can be done about all the things that we know are wrong, who can do it, who should be involved, and where do we go from here. Thank you so much for this first conversation on violence and what's happening out there in the streets and the killings.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're very welcome.
Because people can be killed both emotionally and psychologically as well as physically
Absolutely.
By many of the things that you've described. I'm Gene Moore. You've been listening to part one of what will be a two-part conversation discussing issues of violence and issues of families in the various cities and particularly African-American communities in our cities that we know need a great deal of help. I'm Gene Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.